Thanks for joining us for the MassMEP Manufacturing Podcast, Transforming Manufacturing Enterprises. MassMEP believes that there are some elements to a manufacturer's business, whether it's finding their inefficiencies, strengthening their internal processes, or even unlocking their growth, that can extend a manufacturer beyond its current limitations. So every episode, take a journey with us as we speak with manufacturers, legislature, subject matter experts, and so many more as we head down the path of manufacturing across the state of Massachusetts. Whether we're in Boston, Worcester, or out in Springfield, maybe even in the Berkshires, we'll be here every week and we'll explain to you more about manufacturing and what's happening right in your own backyard.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us for the MassMEP Manufacturing Podcast. I'm your host, Haley Steele, and today we are talking about cybersecurity, CMMC, all things that are tech-related, a little bit of everything, actually, is what we're going to get into. But we have a couple of new guests with us today. I think John has been with us before, but he's done a webinar with us before, but Pete has not. So we want to welcome them both. So we have with us today, Mr. John Sinopoli. He's the president and CEO of Synergex. So welcome, John.
Hi, Haley. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. And we have for definitely very first time with us, and we're going to make this as easy and as fun for him as possible, Mr. Pete Morin, and he is the CTO of Synergex. So welcome, Pete.
Thank you, Haley. It's a pleasure being with you today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks. So you guys are in Pittsfield, correct?
That's right. That's right. The little known part of the state out in the far west.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have a couple of friends out there. We did some chats with a couple of weeks ago, and we'll talk about how you guys kind of connect with them as well. It's a small world out there and how nice the Berkshires are and getting people out that way. So that's we're trending people out that way right now, I think, is what we're trying to do.
Totally. The water's fine over here. Absolutely.
That's awesome. So before we get started, I always like to ask everybody a question. These guys are such anticipation right now. They're on the edge of their seats. Like, what is she going to ask? What is this question going to be? So the question I'm going to ask you is, was there something during the pandemic that you always thought was a complete drag to do, but for some reason, kind of a light came over and was like, you know what, this isn't bad. I don't mind doing this anymore. And now you kind of enjoy doing it.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting one. Do you have one off the top, Pete?
I wouldn't say that there was anything that was an absolute drag. It was amazing that the amount of time I got to spend with my family and closed up in a house for a couple months stretch, and going into it thinking, oh, I don't know I've ever had this opportunity, not understanding, yeah, can I get through this and not all of us rip each other apart and being in such close confined space for so long. And I feel like my relationship with my wife got better, and certainly with my children through that. So I'm thankful for that opportunity with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think normally, you know, we're hunkered down, especially in the winter out here, right? In the Northeast in the cold weather. I don't know. Yeah, call me optimistic, but you know, I didn't really have much that was a drag outside of, you know, what was happening, you know, worldwide and all the news. I thought, you know, the time it was nice to kind of reprioritize and be able to balance have some time to balance some things out. So, all in all, you know, yeah, I guess just wasn't a drag, Haley. It was a good time. We enjoyed it.
That's great. When it's kind of funny because we were talking about it the other day at work and saying, I can't believe it's been a year. Like, who would have thought, right? A year ago when this all started happening, we're like, oh, a couple of weeks, you know, a couple of weeks turns into a couple of months, a couple of months turns into a year. So it's insane. And I spoke to Ben Sosny from the BIC, and they had their grand opening on February 28th.
Oh, I know. I know. Perfect timing.
Right. And then turns around and 2 weeks later, it's like, bam, shut down. So what was crazy is he had something going on. And then I remember him saying, like, they just announced the first case and it was out by where you guys are. Right. Yeah. So he just kind of, I said, can you believe that it's been a year? So I think what's funny is a lot of people, when you get put into a situation like that, a lot of people look at it and go, oh, you know, but it actually became more silver linings than anything. And it did kind of open eyes and people's eyes and their perspective as to things that were going on, which is kind of, you know, like why we're talking to you today and knowing that, you know, people all of a sudden were thrust into this world of technology and online and you couldn't be with people. So you had to pivot and find ways to do things when it came to communicating with each other. And it was through computers and devices. And so cybersecurity was one of those things that was, at first it was kind of the fun thing, like we're being, you know, Zoom bombed and people are, you know, they're getting into my links, but, you know, coming from your perspective, what do you, you know, how do you see that it's kind of been shaped over the past year?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's funny you bring up the Berkshire Innovation Center. We actually had done some speaking with them and discussion around innovation when all of this started, right? Ben had asked me the question, said, oh, you know, what is going to be the next big thing in technologies? All very excited about all these new collaboration tools that are popping up and everything that's happening. And he was disappointed when I said to him, Ben, the next big thing in technology is going to be security. you know, but I think that just comes from, you know, Pete and I have been doing, you know, we've been in this trade for some time, and there's always that balance between convenience and security, right? If things are really accessible and easy to use and lots of folks are adopting, you know, it's pretty common that that's going to be a platform that's less secure. And so in an environment where we're leaping in and we're using applications and building this demand in this marketplace, right? If you were a business owner, right? If you owned Zoom, right? Would you be taking that time to reinvest in cybersecurity, or would you be trying to, you know, trying to build your platform to be scalable and easy enough so that your business grows very quickly? And I think early on we saw a little bit of that with Zoom, but you know, I think we at Synergex, you know, we spent a lot of time over the last year, you know, focused on that, trying to balance, you know, the convenience with security, and working, you know, with and especially in manufacturing and compliance, where we're now starting to see we're forced to pay attention.
And Haley, you had mentioned, we had a brief conversation before this call about how important cybersecurity is, not just for these manufacturers. Yes, we're going to spend some time talking about that from a CMMC perspective and how we're helping these small manufacturers meet those goals. But all organizations have to meet that cybersecurity level that to protect themselves. Here in Berkshire County, we see more and more companies that are approaching us that have been hit by some kind of malware attack. And it's just, and in my presentation that I give when I walk in initially for these CMMC assessments, one of my slides is, okay, why are we doing this? Of course, one is because we're required to do it. But the bigger one is, if we're not doing that, what kind of risk are we putting ourselves at? So all organizations need to look at cybersecurity, how we're going to protect ourselves, and just continue to see, okay, what's out there, what kind of attacks are happening, that we're not safe from that. We can't just put it on the back burner and forget about it.
Yeah, it's almost like, I mean, we obviously are big into lean and we say it's a journey, but I feel like this is the same kind of thing, right? It's always evolving, constantly changing. So you guys are really constantly trying to keep up with what's going on and what's happening. And I mean, and so do you think that from the past year, do you think it opened it up more? Do you think it became more aware? Was it always there? It was just kind of one of those things where people were like, eh, whatever, I'm good.
It's difficult. You know, I think it's, to some degree, it's always been there. I think it's tough to, if you own a business and you're not focused on it and you think, you know, that your technology is less critical, it's a tough investment, right? It's a significant investment to make. That, and, you know, I think there's also a lot of misconception, you know, around what some of this tooling and process is all about. You know, there are a lot of companies out there that sell it, right? Some, you know, some more technology focused, some more business and strategy focused. So there's just a lot out there. So I, you know, I think what's happening now is helping, you know, folks to become educated, to at least consider that, you know, some of this stuff is critical. And if this situation were to happen, right, global pandemic, cybersecurity, things are full assault, you know, and I was shut down, you know, what would that mean to me, you know, as a business owner? I think some of that stuff is definitely more relevant.
Yeah, it's almost, you say, you know, when you say the people, the misconceptions and the financial side of it, we've talked to people who have said, if only I would have made the adjustments when I had, you know, whether it be funding, you know, whether it's something that we can help with getting them funding in some way or another, and would have actually gone through the process versus I didn't, because I didn't understand the necessity of it. And then something happened and it cost me way more than I ever could have imagined. And that's, we on our end, we try to educate that way and try to help them understand, yes, this may be an investment up front, but it, your return on that is, you know, you can't put a number on it.
Right. If you talk to some of these smaller organizations that have been hit with ransomware attacks, it's incredibly costly. Even if they're able to recover that data from backups and not have to pay some kind of fee to recover that, it's just, they can't measure that, like you said, going into it, what will that cost them?
Right. Yeah. And time. I mean, you know, no one ever gets hit with ransomware at the opportune time, right? It's always in the middle of that right. Big project. Like, oh no.
Yeah. That's funny. So let's talk about Synajax. So where did Synajax come from?
Yeah, great question. We are a relatively younger MSP. We're a four-year-old company. It's, you know, we started this business because we felt like, you know, that there was some opportunity there to be able to work with businesses in a different way. You know, Peter and I both worked for a larger public company in internal IT in a highly regulated environment. So we're very familiar with risk and working at a business level, right? And Pete and I, you know, I don't want to paint the wrong picture. We are geeks. We're both very technical. We can build networks and servers. We just don't want to do that anymore. but it gives us a, you know, I think in regard to the business and sort of how we approach our customers. We believe that business owners want IT to be a commodity, right? We want it to be simple and accessible. But we also understand that there's a lot of moving pieces, right? There are all these cybersecurity elements, and we need the geeks, and we need service, and we need all of this stuff. But I don't want to talk about any of it. I just want it to work, which in my eyes is the way it should be. You know, as much as I have to do accounting for Synajax on an occasional basis, you know, I would love if I didn't have to, right? We want to do what we do, and so Synajax is born to do that, to enable business owners, right, to kind of outsource the IT problem, and do it in a way that's with predictable fee, you don't have to worry about, you know, oh, you know, John's in the closet, you know, with the server for 8 hours. How much is that going to cost me? Oh my God. we try to eliminate that and really become more that internal IT resource, right? We just do it for the small to medium sized business, and it's what we love to do.
So you guys have known each other for a long time?
Yeah, John and I think it's been a little over 15 years now. So.
Oh, you remembered Pete? You know what?
I kind of feel like I'm in the middle of a relationship here. Like, oh, you know our anniversary day? Like,
oh,
wow,
man, I missed it.
You know the story? Yeah, so Matt through Berkshire Bank, like John said, in our heart, we're IT geeks. Had a lot of other interests though outside of IT, and that's how we kind of came together and got to know each other better. I would say a lot of what John has built in Synergex came from conversations that we'd have back in those days on what did we think was key for a small IT company and providing these services for these other smaller organizations in this area. There's so many in Berkshire County, and we're expanding beyond Berkshire County, helping throughout the state and areas, surrounding areas. So what do they need and how can we help them meet these IT goals and especially now cybersecurity goals, right?
Yeah, nobody likes to go to the mechanic and be told, you know, you need $1,000 for a new flux capacitor, right? And so we're trying to sort of break that all down, make it more accessible, and obviously just focus on business. And CMMC has actually been a welcome opportunity for us to engage with folks, you know, that now recognize that they need it, right? So man, that overwhelming feeling, you know, when we see this big list of things we have to do, I mean, that's what we want to take away. So it's really, it's been a nice opportunity for us to help work with and coach and do what we think we do best.
Yeah. So, and you touching on CMMC. So, you know, right now we have the DFARS interim rule, and it's definitely creating, like, and you hit on it, John, a complete sense of urgency. It went into effect in November, right, of last year. So now if you are, so CMMC is, you basically are a defense contractor, right? They're working with the DOD, but what do they have to do that they need to comply in order, you know, for the CMMC?
So it's interesting, like you brought up the DFARS clause. With the DFARS clause, what they're pushing is that these companies meet what was originally the NIST 800-171 methodology. So before December or November last year, they were basically saying, okay, for years, the NIST existed, this 800-171, please meet these cybersecurity requirements. And you basically just self-assessed and tried to meet these goals. They found that no one was doing this. In early 2020, they decided, the DOD said, okay, everyone needs to meet the CMMC requirement. They developed this all based off the original NIST assessments and said, by the end of 2020, all these manufacturers, whether they're in the supply chain at the level of a Lockheed Martin or down to making a tiny little widget, you all have to meet these requirements. They bit off a lot though by saying, well, we're going to do this by the end of 2020. So end of 2020 approaches, the DFARS clause gets released, and it seemed like they took a step back a little bit and said, okay, we're not going to require you to meet all these CMC requirements right now, but you must step up and hit these original NIST requirements. And that's truly at the core of the DFARS clause. What they're saying is, okay, here's what we had built out in the NIST assessment. Everyone show us where you're at with this now and show us what your plan is to meet those goals moving forward.
Right, kind of a simple scoring metric, and if I'm guessing, right, a way to sort of, from a supply chain perspective, very quickly sort of identify where people are, right, on their path.
Yeah.
Nice that we have some time, but I think, you know, probably something, you know, sooner than later, it makes sense to start to to migrate, right? I don't know. I'm not a, you know, obviously we're not manufacturing parts, but you know, if I was and I knew this was coming, you know, I'm not sure I would want to be on the red side of that score for 3 years.
Yeah. So, and you talk about timing. Is there a time that it takes for compliance for some of these companies, and you know, like, are averaging, or what are you guys seeing?
That's an interesting one. You know, I think, I guess I'll address that with just sort of suggesting that folks that are in this space trying to provide services for CMMC, some of them are looking at it as a sales opportunity for IT tooling. Yeah. I mean, you know, some of that is likely going to be required, but what we speak more, you know, to the risk of the business, to strategic compliance. I think the better way to look at this is a strategic path, because there is more to do with process and sort of digesting that cybersecurity as part of your life now, than there is sort of concern about project deployment, right? Or about IT tooling. A lot of this stuff, you know, can be done depending on the size of the organization without technology, right? Compliance may point out that something is very specifically needed. Well, it depends, right, Pete? I mean, you know, like some of the encryption stuff, it depends, right? And sort of where it lived, what we're using.
That's correct. And even, okay, so where or how you handle this CUI or controlled unclassified information? Well, in policy, you may be able to say, there's one specific question that asks, how do you transport that CUI? Well, you may be small enough that I don't have that requirement to transport. So you write within policy how you're going to handle that CUI, and that transportation may just not be involved in that system. So that's one example of saying, okay, let's use a process and procedure to just write in how we can handle that. And there are many, like John said, with encryption, there could be a policy and procedure that you put in place that can avoid how you're going to store that with encryption. Something simple along those lines, but the core, you meet level one by just putting some practices in place. The next step, the level two, is all written around policy and procedure. And yes, there are some things you'll have to implement on a technical side in there, but the majority in that middle section is just policy and procedure. Writing that, implementing it, making sure it's in place, that the staff and employees within the organization understand it and live by it.
We see, you know, some of our clients who really want to be assertive about compliance, whether they see it as a business opportunity or just something they want to get out of the way, which is doable. You know, we'd argue that that's a, you know, very expensive route, right? And also a bit of a culture shock, right? But it absolutely is doable. You know, where it's possible, we're really guiding folks to kind of take a bit more of that, you know, planned out approach. Let's look at the list of items, right? So we're doing assessments, we're going through the CMMC compliance, we're summarizing some of that stuff into projects, right? Something that a CEO can digest. Here's 10 things that we need to accomplish in whatever amount of time, right? It could be a month, it could be a year, it could be 3 years, depending on where we wanna go, right? And how soon we wanna be compliant. But the more that we can kind of, you know, spread this out and bite it off in small chunks, you know, the more likely it is that the culture is going to adopt these changes, right? And is going to actually live them rather than feel like it's something that we're doing, you know, to them. We're talking about things like change control, right? Like SDLCs, right? Very refined processes for how we deploy things. Even some of the technology, right? If we're not used to multi-factor authentication and having to, you know, get a text message and type all this stuff. I mean, sometimes there's a big culture shift there. So, you know, as far as timeline is concerned, we're really trying to get to know the business, understand the pace and the why, and work with them, you know, to build a compliance plan that makes sense. And, you know, one of the biggest things, you know, that we try to leave is that, you know, if we think about technology and the pace of technology, you know, 3 years from now, think about it, right? Where are we going to be with all of this stuff? Is compliance going to be the same as it is today?
Yeah.
Probably not. So if we're working towards, you know, compliance, really, we need to make sure that we have a process and a program, right? A strategic plan so that as things evolve, we can adjust to that. And we're moving towards this goal. If we just slam it in now, and then 3 years from now, there's 20 new things. Well, there's 20 new things you have to slam in, right? Because, you know, we didn't do it methodically.
That's right. You asked Haley how long is this going to take to be compliant? That's really unknown right now. We don't know. It's not clear when a company could actually be compliant, when a third party auditor can come in and actually certify that organization as being compliant. And like John said, in the next 3 years, we could see these rules change again. I think what these contractors are looking for and what the DoD is looking for is that you are moving in the correct path to close all these gaps, get that plan of action in place and start completing those projects. And then when we're getting closer to that 2025 date, when you have to meet compliance, that you're ready. And there may be only a couple small projects that might need to be complete at that time. And some of what's written into the DFARS is saying that you're not expected to be a fully level 3 or level 4, whatever it is today. You would have some time if you were in the middle of the contract process. So if you're trying to complete a contract, they would say, okay, in this contract, you have to be level 2 or level 3 compliant. Where are you at today? So you prove what needs to be done to meet if it's level 3 compliance, and you would have some time before the end of that closing of the contract to actually complete that process and be there and certified.
Yeah, it almost seems to me like, obviously from the outside looking in, it's like they just graduated the first 100 auditors, right? So they just graduated them. And by the time they get them up to speed, there's going to be something different that's going to change again. So it definitely is, it's a constant journey, and there's continuous improvement. It seems that goes on every single day, you know, every moment of every day of moving forward with this. But so let me ask you this question though. So once you're in and you're going through compliance, you go, like you're saying, you know, you can chunk it out and maybe go by steps, but there's no partial, right? You're when you're compliant as to what they currently have out that the standards are.
That's right. That's right. Yep. Yeah. You know, it's really just more of, you know, we like to use the whole people, process, tools, thought process here. You know, compliance is about all three, right? So the people part, you know, in general, takes a bit of time to move. So, you know, the thought of buying a tool, deploying it, checking the box and saying I'm compliant is really a thought process we try to steer away from.
That's cool. And, you know, like we said earlier, you know, obviously cybersecurity isn't just for DoD, you know, it's for everybody. And at MassMEP, we're, you know, our bread and butter is our manufacturers. So we like to focus on them. And obviously this is the audience that we're reaching out to today. And we've said about, you know, hackers, I told you guys about a company that I spoke with, you know, and he said, yeah, our email was completely wiped out. So, you know, it seems that people need to understand, you can definitely have kind of like a, we're saying like a six-figure impact almost that it could have on you.
Easily.
So, you know, we talk about the 800-171, we do the ISO 27001, you know, what are the, being able to, I guess, have the right framework for them and making sure they're going down the right path. And if you could just kind of give them some insight as to, maybe where they should be looking and what the, obviously we want to have them reach out to you guys and, you know, and you guys work with CyberSaint, who we work with as well. So I guess just some general information for them to know, okay, this is, it seems a little overwhelming almost, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So if you could minimize it for them a little bit, what's going to be the best maybe first steps to take?
I mean, I'd suggest, and thank you for bringing up CyberSaint. They're a wonderful partner to us. You know, we work with CyberSaint in a number of different industries across the country. We've done, you know, NIST 853 assessments, you know, obviously, you know, 800-171 and all the manufacturing cybersecurity standards now. But I think, if I were going to offer some general counsel or advice that, and make keep it simple, you know, pick a framework. If you're not regulated, it pick one. You know, it doesn't really matter, except, right, you know, we need some sort of a baseline to get an understanding of where we are in relation to some sort of, you know, standard. 853 was originally designed, you know, for government, but it's now being adapted. NIST is really, you know, suggesting that this is something that everyone should consider. We worked with furniture companies, right? Retailers, you name it, just to do that, right? Just to say, here, give me an assessment, give me a sense of where we need to look. And it applies, you know, from 5 employees to, you know, 50,000, it doesn't matter. So, you know, I think starting with something, right? If I'm a new leader walking into a company and I want to get a sense for what my job looks like for the next 3 days, mm-hmm. having an assessment, having a baseline you know, something that you can speak against and work with a team to say, hey, you know, here's what this looks like. Let's decide, you know, what level of compliance we want to achieve and what investments we need to make to get there in time and money. I think there's a lot of value in that.
And I think that 800-171 is a great starting point for any company. I feel working with it that it's a very simplified assessment model for any organization to get involved in. So, and it really touches on all aspects of cybersecurity. And then, like I said, from even the policy and procedure. And yes, some organizations may not want to focus, as much on the policy and procedure side, that's fine, but take the nitty-gritty parts of the cybersecurity model that's in there and implement that in any organization, and they're going to be in a much better place.
Yeah, for sure.
So you said, I guess another thing, we get a lot of the questions is what's the differentiation between the DFARS and the 800-171?
You want to take that one, Pete?
So I think I spoke a little bit about it earlier. The DFARS is just putting together, kind of enforcing it, that's saying that, okay, now the top tier players, the primes in this world, need to push that down to their subcontractors. So it's all based on the NIST 800-171 model, but it's enforcing that if you're a Raytheon or a Lockheed Martin, one of those primes, that you're ensuring that your subcontractors, the people making the smaller pieces in that, are meeting the same level of compliance in that NIST 800-171 model that they're expected to meet. And of course, it's also built in a framework that works for that organization that's 5 users or 25 users up to the large organization. And they've built it in a way that it's not as costly when you are down at that level than as the large organization. So it fits and can be flexible no matter what size. But in the summary, it's that you're expected to meet that 800-171 model at all levels, and ensuring that all your contractors, so even if you're not the Raytheon, but you have subcontracts for these pieces and parts, that you're ensuring that those companies are also meeting the same cybersecurity rules.
Haley, not to go sideways, but you know, have you ever tried these new VR headsets?
I have not, and reason being because I'm paranoid I might get sick.
So I just tried my first time a week ago, and it's amazing. It's amazing how immersive this experience can be for $300, right?
Yeah.
And as I'm in this headset, I'm thinking to myself, like, this is definitely part of our future, right? This experience is going to become more than just video games and virtual reality. It's so impressive. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, being the cybersecurity nut, I start thinking to myself, like, whoa, okay, if this is the new world, right? Not to freak anybody out, but we better have this other stuff in check, because this is all digital. This is life in digital. I think the point I'm trying to make is, you know, that, you know, all this stuff is evolving. You know, all of these regulations that are coming at us, they're I know they're aggressive, but they're healthy, right? They're things that we really need to think about, because you know, we're going to be talking to technology using virtual reality, and if we don't have these things in check, then that world is really impossible.
Yeah, we talk a lot about additive manufacturing, you know, and that has a lot to do with the augmented reality, and you know, they using those goggles, or whatever they're going to call them, that you put them on, you can have a person that is at home working from home, and they may be the engineer behind that machine. And then the person that's actually with the machine can't, you know, puts them on and learns how to, if the machine breaks down, learns how to fix the machine, so that then the machine gets fixed, they don't ever go down. So they're continually with their output, and it just doesn't affect their flow of their process whatsoever. I mean, it's uncanny where, you know, it's headed. Yeah, we do. And we do, you're right. We do a lot. And that's why we like to do this. We kind of do it like in layers. You know, we're layering in where we're saying we're looking at, you know, additive. And there are some people that are like, I'm good, I'm comfortable, we like what we do. You know, and they get, there's a lot of misconceptions with that as well. And people thinking, you know, that takes people out of jobs, and it really doesn't. It actually does the opposite. It progresses them, because those machines don't just run. We're not at that point. This isn't Terminator level where, you know, we've got there, you know, he's out there and he's making things work. People have to program that. So you have to have individuals know and understand how to program and how to do processes. I mean, we work with all types. We have a manufacturer who literally, there's an ordering system that comes in from a computer, and that, you know, cybersecurity, making sure that cybersecurity is, it's on there tight, that when that order comes in, placing that order, it goes into the computer runs the program, then it's programmed in, it runs the part gets produced, built, package shipped, and it's out the door, all through a computer. And right. Then you still have people that are walking around on the shop floor every day, you know, and they're still doing the processes as well, because there's other elements to it. It can't just be operating on its own. So yeah, we love to be able to, you know, layer things up and let people know. And we kind of see it as building blocks and helping them understand that you have to start with a strong foundation, just like in anything, right? So you know, you have a strong foundation, and then from there you can build off of that. And for us, we want manufacturers, obviously, in the state who have all of these in place for themselves as to what fits their needs and their operations in the moment, so that they can stay here, because we're kind of selfish. We like having, you know, our manufacturers in the state. We don't want them to go anywhere else. You know, it helps all of us, right? I wouldn't be able to do what I do if it wasn't for the manufacturers, you know, that are operating here. So, and you guys as well, you know, making sure that you're reaching, obviously, yeah, you're out, you know, you're out in Pittsfield and you're in Western Mass, but you reach a lot farther than that. So that's where our goal is. So yeah, we definitely are looking to keep pushing it forward with everyone. And this is just one of the bases of the foundation that we're looking at doing.
Makes sense. We love Massachusetts too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny. I've lived in a lot of different states. And I do say this a lot. This is the first time I've ever lived in Massachusetts, but coming from the pandemic, fortunately on our side, we got to see a lot of, you know, what goes on behind the scenes. And I never really understood how much pride there was within the state and the companies that work and operate here until the pandemic, and then actually speaking with a lot of these organizations and these manufacturers and them saying that their, you know, their staff, when they were deemed essential, you know, the staffs were like, we have to make this work. Like, we are making a difference, and the pride that that carried across. So yeah, the state is very, very full of pride. It's, there's a lot of stuff going on here in Mass. Sometimes I feel like, I like to say that we're the first to be doing this stuff, whether we are or not, but we're going to go with that because that, that works for us right now. So yeah.
There is a lot that happens in the state, and you know, we have a lot to offer, right? You know, the variety in seasons, the culture, the great craft beer. I mean, we're like the craft beer mecca of the country. I mean, there's a lot of good reasons to be in Massachusetts. So yeah, we love it here too.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, it's funny you say that. I was, my family's from Pennsylvania, and, you know, speaking with somebody, and my husband's like, yeah, I know a guy that drives 5 hours to go to a specific brewery yes. that will remain nameless in Central Mass. And, I'm like, 5 hours? What? Why? And he comes up, he spends some ungodly amount of money, and he gets his supply, we'll say, for maybe like 3-4 weeks, and then he's back up here again.
So, that's right. That's right.
I guess I'm missing the boat somewhere. Like, I need to be. Maybe I'm not doing the right thing. Maybe I should have got into craft beer.
You're not on the craft beer train? Oh, man. I thought that was a COVID-19 requirement.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I slowly got it. I do have a lot by me, obviously. Out in Central Mass, I have, you know, there's quite a few around me. So we visited them all and did some sampling, you know, just to make sure everything's good. But yeah, you're right. It is. It's a pretty diverse area. It's a great place to be. So as far as, like, I say, you know, we reach really far across, you know, we may be one of the smaller states, but it's really large in impact when you take a step back and look at it. So, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys for joining me today. I appreciate it. The content was phenomenal. I think a lot of people are going to get a lot out of this, and we'll make sure that if they have any questions, we can steer them to you, either of you. You can always reach out to them. Their website is synergex.com. So if you go onto their website, and I'm pretty sure you have, yeah, there's a help section right there and everything. So, and they're also on Instagram. So I give Kaylee some props on Instagram. They have a great Gram site. So you got to go onto the Gram and look them up. Lots of videos. Pete's in some videos. I think John's done some videos. They're old pros now. So
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And we'll have you guys back. We'll be touch and base too. We want to, you know, obviously, as like you said, this is a journey and we're on, you know, with the changes and everything. So we'll be, you know, reach back out to you guys, follow up. And if there's any changes or anything, you know, they'll let me know and we'll make sure that we let everybody else know. So, yeah. So thanks, guys. Yeah. Thanks for
being so much for including us today.
Absolutely. No, this is great. So, yeah. Thanks everyone for joining us. And we'll see you guys soon.
Thank you for listening to the MassMEP Manufacturing Podcast, Transforming Manufacturing Enterprises. You can subscribe to our channel anywhere you listen to your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and you can always go to our website at massmep.org. So we'll see you next time, whether it's our space, your space, or cyberspace.